Welcome to Rise of the Rule Lords. It's me, your organized and playful Rule Lord, Pete. And today, I am really excited to talk about a subject of one of my favorite things about Pathfinder, which is Pathfinder Society. It's actually how I first started GMing for Pathfinder. It's how I got my home group together. It's even how I got into Pathfinder in the first place, back when first edition was the only edition out on the market. So it's something that's really close to my heart. But having done Beginner Box Day, I saw that there was a lot of trepidation about it from both players and GMs alike. And I wanted to take an episode to demystify that, especially as we are getting close to PaizoCon as well as con season. And these kind of society games are going to be all over the place at local conventions, at national ones, even at your friendly local game store. And I am very lucky today to have Paizo's own organized play coordinator, Alex Spidell, and organizer of the Paizo Workers Union. Welcome, Alex.
Hello. It's lovely to be here. If you're organized and playful, I'll be playfully organized and we'll go well together today.
Well, I am so glad that you're able to talk to us today because I really do want to get more people into organized play. I think it's a great way for especially those who keep on saying they can't find a group, they can't find a way to play Pathfinder as a way to actually get into the game. There's just a couple of extra steps involved in it, but I don't think that they're scary steps the thing. So we're going to go over that. But first off, I want to find out a little bit more about you. So, Alex, what's your history with Paizo and organized play?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I have been working for Paizo since February of 2020. So, it's been quite a ride. I was a volunteer. I was a venture agent for about 6 months before that. But just like you, I started playing. For me, it was Starfinder because I'm a sci-fi guy. That's kind of where my heart is. But organized play was how I got into this. Someone brought home the rulebook from Gen Con in 2017. When it came out, I said, that sounds really cool. I went to a demo event and then I was all in. I went to our local convention. I went to Origins in Columbus the next year. I reached out to the local organizers and I said, hey, I would love to run Starfinder. I would love to make Starfinder happen here. How do I do that? And they set me up and now here I am 4 or 5 years later as the organized play coordinator here, kind of doing the operational work of the program. I work with our developers who create the actual content that people play and who help me out with the rules. But my job is kind of the nitty gritty, getting people scenarios, coordinating events and conventions and things like that, and just doing those things to get the scenarios from a thing that is a PDF out into the world so that people can play them.
And you're also the sanctioner.
I am one of the people who works on our sanctioning process. I will not take sole responsibility. And indeed, I rely very heavily on our developers. There are things that I know I'm good at and things that I know that I'm not. And rule balance, game balance is not a thing that works well in my brain. So I'm very grateful for my coworkers who understand what a game balance looks like, our wonderful design team, our wonderful developers, who can take me by the hand and say, yes, this works, and no, this does not.
That's my little tongue-in-cheek question. Sure. Is there anything Paizo could make that you would not sanction? Like, what's involved with the sanctioning process?
Yeah, absolutely. So what you're referring to is when new rule books or content comes out for our games, we put them through what is called the sanctioning process due to, I don't know, that's what it used to be called. But it's basically, we look at the book, we look at the options within it, and we kind of determine what we will or won't allow within our organized play campaigns. And it's sort of one of the big kind of differences, but it's really not that different from a home game, because as a GM, you're going to look at a book and say, yes, I want this in the game, or no, I don't. I run a Strength of Thousands group, and when Guns and Gears came out, I said, that's a really cool book. I don't really want to be doing Guns and Gears in our Strength of Thousands game. So it's the same kind of stuff a home GM does. But when we look at it for organized play, we kind of have to look at it because we run a global campaign with thousands and thousands of players. We have to look at these options from a much, much wider wider range of, like, not just a balance question, not just is this balanced or not, because our games are pretty good about that. But also we're kind of looking at it like, if you sit down with a group of random strangers at your game store or at a convention, is this an appropriate option? Is this rule that says you get a bonus when you, like, drink the enemy's blood or whatever, is that appropriate for all audiences? Is that something we really want to be allowing and encouraging in the campaign? And so on top of the balance, there's a lot of nuance to, like, especially stuff that we didn't care as much about 10 years ago. Things like mind control spells. We look at it and it's like, is this okay? Is this something we really want to be encouraging on top of just outright evil stuff? And we're very cognizant that our game is a game about combat fundamentally, right? That's a big part of the game. And we're not going to say, no, you can't have violence or these things. You can't have combat. You can't have conflict. But we have to look at, if I sit down with strangers, is this okay? If I'm sitting in a game store and playing and the table next to me is listening in on what we're doing, are they going to be alarmed by what they hear the Pathfinder doing? You know, so it's a process, and we really do take care as much as possible to give people as many toys as possible. Sure. You do sometimes have to say, if this is the kind of thing that would be left up to GM adjudication, if this is the kind of thing that a GM would want to have a conversation with their players about, sometimes it's best for us to just kind of put the brakes on it, because it is a global campaign with thousands of players.
So that's not too different from what the big card playing games do with, like, limiting card styles or deck options, it sounds like.
Yeah, 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 pretty much, you know, the same kind of thing that, like, Magic will do with the ban list or something. It's very rare, especially in second edition, that we'll have to, like, put the hammer on something for being, like, too good or affecting the metagame such as it is. But occasionally there are options that come through that it's like, this could have probably used another pass, we'll put the kibosh on that. And then the other thing is, because it's a living game, right, if errata comes out that brings that option back into line with the rest of the game, we'll say, great, you can have that now.
Yeah.
Sounds like fun. Have fun with it. So we're always looking at what changes the designers are making and making sure the game is in line with those.
So you bring up errata, and I know that this is the question that everyone's going to be thinking about. You're a Paizo guy. Obviously, that means you can tell us every single thing about the remaster right now, right?
Absolutely. Let me reveal all of the secrets. No, truly, like, we're very excited about the remaster, and obviously we've got tons of questions about how is this going to affect Pathfinder society? What's going to happen to my characters? And if there's anything I want to use this as, like, a bullhorn for, it's the message that your characters will be fine. Mm. Please continue playing your characters. Please, like, assume you'll be able to continue playing your characters through and beyond the remaster. I have not seen the books yet. The books have not gone to the printers yet. Yeah. So we're not ready to come out and say, like, this is definitely how we're going to handle this, because the books still aren't done. Things could change, and I don't want to say something that is later untrue. Mm. But as soon as the books are at a point where we can start reviewing them, and again, that's sort of part of the sanctioning process, right? But we're going to review them, and we are going to make the transition as easy as possible for everybody to make sure that all of your characters still work. If anything has to change, we will give you explicit guidance on how to do it. We're very cognizant of, like, the problems that can arise here. But do I have all of the answers yet? I do not. And I wish I did. Yeah, I wish I could put out, like, this is exactly how it's going to work. This is what you will or won't have to rebuild. Like, you know, I can't yet. Rest assured that we are going to take all of the time we need to review it and make sure that everything continues working, because we want you to keep playing your characters. We don't want to hideously disrupt things, and we're going to let you keep doing it.
So even though there's going to be some changes, it sounds like Pathfinder Society that we're going to be talking about will largely work in the same way, both before and after the remaster. There'll just be changes that we're already anticipating. There won't be Magic Missile. It'll be something else.
Sure. And, you know, that's the thing, is maybe your wizard will cast Magic Missile, or maybe they'll cast Force Missile, or whatever the heck we call it in the new game. But our goal is that whether your wizard was built 4 years ago when the game was released, or it's built a week after the remaster comes out, they can still play in the same game, right? Gotcha. Those rules still exist. If your wizard knows Magic Missile, our hope is that we're not going to have to tell you, no, you don't any. The goal is we're going to be able to say, yeah, you still know Magic Missile. That rule still exists. That's certainly the hope. That's certainly the goal, that we have to make as few changes as possible, because the worst thing we could do is just throw a whole upheaval at everything.
Sure. So we've talked about Pathfinder Society, but haven't yet defined it. So what is Pathfinder Society, and how does it differ from what a game master or players would do just at their home table?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Start with the 30,000 view there. So Pathfinder Society is our worldwide living campaign. We have thousands of players around the world playing thing in it. And there are two things that, like, I would say are the cornerstones of what Pathfinder Society is. You know, first of all, as I said, it's a living campaign. Player actions influence what happens in the campaign. We have, when GMs report their scenarios back to us, they say, we played this game on this date and players earned this. We'll ask them questions like, did such and such NPC survive? Did what happened to the bad guy? Did you capture them? Did you kill them? Did they escape? Did you make friends with this person? What side of this conflict did you take? And we take those, and that affects the future. If the bad guy escaped at the end of the scenario, we've just got a recurring villain. If you supported one side or the other versus in some sort of conflict, we know that that's a story that we can then tell in the future that, okay, you picked side A, so the next adventure in this story is going to assume that most people supported side A, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing, is that, like, it is a living campaign. We listen to what the players are doing. And the second thing is that it's designed to be a casual drop-in, drop-out campaign. It's designed for those people who can't commit to, like, a weekly campaign, a bi-weekly campaign, whose schedules don't allow that, who move around a lot, or those people who just don't know other players yet, who want to meet other players like you did and form a new home group and do that. That's a real success story for us. Mm-hmm. It allows people to show up when it's convenient for them and take their characters wherever they go. Those are the two cores of it. There's a player, and I won't name him, but I've had the pleasure of meeting and playing with him. We have a player who I know who's an airline pilot. And literally is constantly flying around the country, around the world, and will just show up to games when he's on layover or when he's got time in a city. And I think he probably holds the record for, like, most different venues or most countries played in, because I know he's played in America, he's played in Australia. He'll hit me up sometimes and say, hey, are there people playing in Japan and, like, Hong Kong and, like, this other city that I've got a long stay over in? And he can do that, right? Because his job doesn't let him have a regular schedule, but because we've got locations around the world, he just show up wherever with his character sheet and say, hey, can I play? And that, I think, is just really great about the program, that you can sort of play wherever you want and know that you're going to be playing with the same rules. And that's kind of, to go back to the sanctuary we talked about at the start, that's a lot of what goes into it, is can we make sure that these rules are going to be interpreted by the same people in California and in Seattle and in New York and in London and right. Make sure that everyone's playing with the same rules, right? But beyond that, we have these scenarios are our main vehicle. They're self-contained 3 to 4 hour adventures. We've got shorter adventures as well. But beyond that, when you sit down at the table, the play experience isn't going to be all that different from when you are playing at home with an adventure path or with a homebrew thing. We give the GMs everything that they need. The rules are the rules. They are what they are. And so for players, they're not going to notice a ton of difference. They just get a 3 to 4 hour adventure. I think they're pretty good adventures personally. I'm a little biased. It just allows people to play in that space as they want to. And I think it's really great, but again, I'm kind of biased. And the other disclaimer I'll say is that I'm talking about Pathfinder Society here because this is a Pathfinder podcast. Everything I say applies to Starfinder Society as well. If you want some sci-fi in your magic, come check out Starfinder Society. It's just as great, but I'm playing to the audience, so we're talking Pathfinder specifically.
So we're going to go into a lot of the depth of it, but what if someone is not quite ready for that and comes to Pathfinder Society with one of those pre-generated character sheets that you have of the Iconics? Mm-hmm. Are they going to be missing out, or are they going to be able to just get in and go?
No, absolutely not. You know, and I know that there's a lot of arcana built into Pathfinder Society and organized play. It's a 15-year-old program. It's built on the bones of RPGA, of Living Greyhawk that came before it. There are all kinds of rabbit holes you can fall down. If you're a player and you just want to get out and play some Pathfinder, like, don't worry about 90%. Show up with a character. Show up with a pre-generated character if you don't even know how to build a character yet. You can totally do that, and it won't change anything. You'll be able to play with that character. You'll get, at the end of every session, you get a chronicle sheet that basically says, here's what you did, here's the gold you earned, and you can apply that to a character once you actually decide to create your own character. Other people just kind of level up the pre-gens as they go and are just like, I enjoy playing Marisil, I'm just gonna level Marisil up as I go and change her name slightly, and we're good to go. But yeah, that's absolutely a valid way to jump in, and honestly the best way to learn Pathfinder Society and its kind of arcana is just to do it at the table. Just sit down with the GM, sit down with the organizer, and just go play some Pathfinder and just have fun. And you'll pick up the rest as you
and
go.
A lot of people got to do that on my personal pet project, Beginner Box Days.
Yes, wonderful.
And many people did play with their own custom characters, and many people played with pregens. But either way, those Chronicle sheets work a little bit differently. So if they participated in Beginner Box Days or just played the Beginner Box at a society, what do they do with that Chronicle sheet to start with Pathfinder Society?
Sure. So at the end, if you got a Chronicle sheet, it's basically for the Beginner Box in particular, for each level of the dungeon, you basically get one scenario's worth of credit, and you level up in Pathfinder Society every three scenarios. So if you played one level, you're already a third of the way to a level two character. But if you got an organized play ID and you got a Chronicle sheet, you just add that number to your Paizo account. You go into the My Organized Play section of Paizo.com and say, hello, I have a number. Here it is. Here's the confirmation code. And then you just apply that Chronicle sheet to your first character. And then you've got some extra gold to start out with. You've got a little bit more hardiness. And then you just continue playing with that character, whether it's the character you built for the Beginner Box, whether it's a pre-gen there, or whether you want to create someone totally new. One of the nice things about Pathfinder Society, we don't lock you into a build until you play for the first time at second level. Mm. So if you have a couple ideas, you want to test them out in a real trial by fire situation, you can totally do that. And they're considered the same ghost of a character, basically, until they hit second level. And then you've kind of got to make a decision. But gotcha. There's also ways you can change it later.
As well. Gotcha. Yeah. But there are certain restrictions, and the question that I kept on seeing was, what kind of elf can I play?
So, oh, love that joke. That joke, actually, it's in my Twitter description. I think when as part of my union organizing efforts, I had a little field trip to the White House. I think one of my union brethren made a joke that I had to explain to my job to the current president of the United States, and he suggested that I do it by saying I tell people what kind of elves they can pretend to be, which is not inaccurate and is very funny.
But there are those restrictions, and it can be a little daunting, I think, to new people. So what are those? Why does that exist? And how can you get more options?
Yeah, so there's a lot of layers to that question. But one of the things that I think people kind of bump up against initially is that we do kind of have, I don't even want to call them restrictions. I'm going to call them like a hurdle, because that's surmountable, right? Mm. To playing some of the odder ancestries or options. You know, skeletons are my big one of like, those are like really hard to play. But even there are some fan favorites like Kitsune that you have to work a little
Shuni.
Bit for. Or, okay, sure, Shuni, or Tengu, or what have you. And that has to do kind of with how we implement the rarity system in Pathfinder 2E, where the design team has said, these things are common, these things are uncommon, these things are rare. And we want to respect that and sort of manage our campaign as closely to what's written in the books as possible. But we also want to let people play those things, because those things are cool, right? Leshies and kobolds and fine Shunis and whatever else. Those are, in many ways, the banners of the program and what brings people in. So we have kind of this, what I'll call a meta currency called achievement points that mm-hmm. you earn every time you play a game. It's basically like a loyalty program. The more you play, the more points you get. How about that? And what you can do is you can redeem those points for boons in an online store. And those boons generally unlock character options. They can also do things like resurrect your character if they die, but mostly they're for shiny options. And that's what you can do to unlock things like Shunis or like Kitsune or these different ancestries, or even sometimes different character options like archetypes, like the Rune Lord dedication. If you want to be a Rune Lord from Secrets of Magic, that's a boon that you redeem achievement points for, right? Mm-hmm. There's several layers to why we do it that way, but the big thing is we want to reward the people who play more. We want to reward the people who GM more, because GMs get more achievement points for running games. So mm-hmm. we want to make sure that there's an incentive, because the program doesn't exist without GMs. And also, to get a little bit into the arcana, it also incentivizes GMs and organizers to report their games to us, because that's right. how you get the achievement points. And it's important to us to have that kind of accurate data. Now, I also see people saying, oh, well, I want to play this thing right now. And the good news is, you start out with a bucket of achievement points. You start out with 80 achievement points just for joining the Pathfinder Society. 80 achievement points gets you an uncommon ancestry, like, not a Sunni, but, you know, like, I was going to say an orc, but orcs are free now. I cannot think of another uncommon ancestry right now. Tengu are uncommon.
Yep.
80 points you can redeem right off the bat to get yourself a nice ancestry. And the kind of things that cost more than that are just the kind of things that are either rare in universe, and therefore sort of logically from a story point make sense to be rarer, or like skeletons, we don't necessarily want a player to start with a skeleton because there's a lot of weird rules that come into play.
Right.
So it makes sense for us to put that gate up and say, hey, you know, just like play a little bit first and then you can do this. Right.
Sure.
But we don't ever want players to feel like they can't play the character they want. We want to give them those paths. We want to give them those options. And, you know, because that's what's the most fun. So I see when people bounce off that and like there are ways for you to get the things you want and you can start with a lot of the things you want right away. And we also change and reduce the price point of these ancestries as things go on. If we do like a big storyline about Tengu, for example, they'll probably get reduced. They'll probably get made free. We're going to Tian Sha soon. You might see some of those associated ancestries become easier to access pretty soon just to kind of get people into that thematic mood. So these things also change over time. They are not set in stone by any stretch.
Sure. Now, yeah. Part of the character creation process is that you get to choose a faction, of which there are six. The yes. Envoys Alliance, the Grand Archive, Horizon Hunters, Radiant Oath, Verdant Wheel, and Vigilant Seal. So what are those factions about, and which one is the best one?
The best faction is whichever one is your favorite, listener. That's right. That one's my favorite, too. So the factions kind of grew out of way back in the old days. The factions were actually the country you were from. And we had like five, like it was Cheliax and Andorin and these different countries. And it was kind of like, which side were you on in ongoing conflicts? That's not really how they work anymore, because the society has become much more friendly and much less these two nations want to cut each other's throats in the night. But it's basically just like a flag that you wave when you go on a mission. The factions all kind of have their own goals. They're not always in conflict, but sometimes they are. But all the factions sort of work together to make the society better and just kind of shape it in the way they want. Mm. So like, for example, the Grand Archive is all about archiving the things that we do, right? The Vigilant Seal is all about locking up all the things that we find that are dangerous and making sure that they can't hurt anybody. The Vigilant Seal can sometimes be in conflict with other factions who want to take out the fun toys and use them. So it can create some within scenario and within storyline kind of conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not intended to be these things where like you're picking sides and fighting at the table. Sometimes scenarios will have specific missions that specific faction leaders will want you to carry out. So the Radiant Oath as, or the Envoys Alliance as well, as big fans of like redeeming people and making friends, might say, hey, while you're there, make sure you talk to this person. We think they could be helpful to us. We'd like to be friends with them. Or the Vigilant Seal might tell you, hey, when you find the scary ball of doom, make sure to destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you complete those missions, you might get a little bit of extra reputation. The faction might like you a little bit more, but that's sort of what they are. And again, the best faction is your favorite, listener.
So what do you do with the reputation once you've got it?
Right. So the reputation is another thing that you earn at the end of a scenario and that gets tracked. And as you gain more reputation with the faction, it unlocks more boons that you can purchase. And oftentimes these are free. Sometimes these cost you a couple of points, but it's basically this faction really likes you. They might give you access to certain character options tied to that faction. They might just owe you a favor that you can call in for bonuses or things like that, but it's just another way to kind of immerse your character more into the world and kind of unlock more options. But again, if this is the kind of thing that you're like, that sounds like a lot, I don't want to deal with it, you don't have to. And none of the rewards are built so that like you're going to be underpowered if you don't engage with them. It's all kind of, you can opt into as much complexity as you want.
So leveling up works a little bit differently, as you already alluded to. Instead of the typical 1,000 XP points, if you go by XP, or I would always prefer milestone.
But, me both.
But there is a certain amount of XP that you earn with these different kinds of sessions, and eventually you get to level up. So how do you level up, and how do you get equipment, especially because I also know that certain spells and items are also locked, like those character options?
Sometimes, yeah. So we actually do kind of use a modified version of the experience system. In the core rulebook, what it says is every 1200 XP, you level up. In Pathfinder Society, we just knock a couple zeros off of that. And we say every 12 XP, you level up. And so for a full scenario, you'll get 4 XP. So 3 times 4 is 12. You'll level up every 3 scenarios. If you play different adventures, you'll get different amounts of experience. So if you play a bounty, for example, that just gets you 1 experience because it's a lot shorter. Mm-hmm. If you have, say, an adventure path volume that you play and you apply to a character, which you can do, that usually gets you 12 XP. So that's a whole level right there. Mm. But when you earn enough XP, you just level up like you do normal, right? Like there's not, we don't add additional complexity necessarily to character creation. It's just you're now level 2. You've earned gold along the way. You can buy stuff with that. But otherwise, you're level 2. Pick your feats, pick your spells if you have spells, pick whatever other abilities, just like normal. And as far as purchasing things, it kind of works the same way. We leave that to the players to say, here's how much gold you earn. Go and buy whatever you can afford within reason, right? For uncommon spells and uncommon equipment, usually when a book gets released, we'll release boons, along with it, where we'll say, hey, if you buy this boon for 20 achievement points, you get access to one of these uncommon equipment items. Boom, done, handled, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes as well, scenarios will give you boons that give you rewards as well. So it might unlock a rarer character option. It might just give you access to equipment you wouldn't otherwise have access to. But there's lots of different ways to get access to whatever shiny toys you want.
So you mentioned boons a couple of times. How do you get those? What are they? And are there any special events or perks in society to give you more?
Boons are basically the blanket term for anything that you buy from our online boon store, which is both things that you spend achievement points on, as well as things, sometimes scenarios will come with a boon that says, for playing the scenario, you now have access to this, right? And that's also where the free boons live that you might get for leveling up within a particular faction. And they're all boons. And your character can have generally as many boons as your printer can print out. And even more than that, truly, because you don't have to print. But boons usually unlock an option. They'll say, for doing this, you now have this. And those just, you apply them to your character, and then it says, you can have this thing, and then you get the shiny things. Back in the day, what we used to have boons for every single scenario, and they would be long and elaborate, but a lot of them would get really weirdly specific, like, you now have a +2 bonus to interacting with bandits from this particular part of the forest, and if those bandits never came up again, then it didn't do anything.
Right.
And so in second edition, we've kind of moved away from that and moved more towards how can we use scenarios to unlock the toys in the books, right?
Yeah.
So not to spoil too much, but we're doing a little mini arc right now about beast guns in Pathfinder Society. Ooh. I wonder if completing the second scenario there might get you a beast gun. Impossible to say, right? But that's something that ordinarily you couldn't get your hands on.
Sure.
But as a reward for playing these scenarios, you get a shiny thing, right?
Gotcha. So when I'm ready to play Pathfinder Society, knowing all of this stuff about how it works, what do I need to show up to a table with?
You can show up to a table with as much or as little of a character as you want. If you show up and you're like, I want to play Pathfinder Society, I don't understand character building yet, just give me a character. The organizers can hand you one of our lovely pre-generated characters, and you can go on a lovely adventure for 4 hours with them that way. If you have a fully fleshed out character that you're like, I already know exactly what I want to do, I want this shuny wizard who has these spells and this things and yada-da-da-da, show up with a fully fleshed out character, plop your mini down on the table, and you're ready to go. And anywhere in between as well. As long as you show up with, I think, enthusiasm and a willingness to play, you will be welcomed at any one of our Pathfinder Society tables.
Fantastic. So now we're going to talk more to the GMs, the true OPs.
Hello, GMs, my beloveds.
So what do they have to do differently to run a Pathfinder Society scenario?
Really, not that much different, right? If you open a Pathfinder Society scenario, and I think this is something that a lot of people don't know, it's not going to look that different from an adventure path volume or some other published adventure. So if you've run APs before, you are overqualified to run a Pathfinder Society scenario. And if you've never run anything in your life before, you are also qualified to run a Pathfinder Society scenario, because as much as possible, we give the GMs everything they could possibly need. We tell them, here's the mission, right? Here's the adventure. Here's how to play the NPCs. Here's box text to read. Here's the monsters. Here's the treasure they might find along the way. And at least for myself personally, when I write adventures, which I do from time to time, I try to hold the GM's hands as much as possible and say, hey, here's a way your PCs might decide to go off the rails. Here's how to handle that when they do it, right? Or, hey, here's a helpful tip. We're about to use this weird subsystem or something. Here's a reminder about that, right? Mm-hmm. We try to make it as easy as possible and give the GMs more than they possibly need. The one major difference that GMs are going to see is that we have options for scaling encounters within the scenarios. Because when we publish a scenario, we publish it for 4 level ranges, because mm-hmm. that helps events and conventions kind of seat people at tables. So the characters who are 1st level and characters who are 4th level can play in the same adventure. You don't have to be right at the same level. So where an AP will say, here's your encounter, you're going to fight 3 dire wolves. Our adventure will say, here's your base encounter, you're going to fight 2 dire wolves. Mm-hmm. And then for every PC you have past 4, you might add another wolf. Or we might say, add an adjustment to these wolves. Or we might say, oh, if this is low level, they're just normal wolves, they're not dire wolves. So there's a little bit more there in terms of like figuring out what level your players are at and scaling accordingly. And you do have to do a little bit of math. My apologies to the GMs. But beyond that, that's it. You have a little bit of paperwork to do. You ask people to sign in and say, here's who I am. At the end, you give them the chronicle sheet to say, here's what I earned, here's what I played. And you report the game back to the website and say, here's what we played. Beyond that extra, maybe 15 minutes of paperwork, it's going to run the same as you do at home. Better than at home, because you don't have to come up with things from your own brain necessarily. We give you hopefully everything you need. You don't have to figure out how the players get interested in the adventure. They're interested because they're Pathfinders and this is their mission today, you know? You don't have to figure out all the colorful NPCs along the way. We give them to you. You might have to improv like a shopkeeper here and there because you know how PCs are.
Right.
But we try to give you as much as you can. So if you run a published adventure before, you're going to be overwhelmed with how much you don't have to do, and it's going to be wonderful.
The only thing that ever kept getting stumped on me whenever I ran Pathfinder Society is there's always a player who asks, what time of day is it?
Like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Daytime.
Yeah, exactly. What are the ceilings like? What's the light level? There's light and you can see, and the ceilings are yo high.
Yeah.
We give you as much as possible, but no plan survives first contact with the players. You know, we do ask you to be a GM and improvise when necessary, but we give you the rails as much as possible. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So there, you've alluded to the different kinds of scenarios that you have for adventures, the scenarios, quests, and bounties. So what are the kinds of games that players and GMs can expect depending on which of those they end up playing?
So scenarios are our, like I say, 3 to 4 hour adventures. They're kind of the bread and butter. And they'll assume that the players are Pathfinders and they will send you on a lovely adventure. And really, we can do any genre of adventures. We've had horror, we've had mystery, we've had comedy, we've had your standard hack and slash, dungeon crawler, big influence scenarios where you have to make friends with people. We can go any kind of direction with them, right? Sometimes the scenarios will be part of what we call our meta plot. Every year we have a meta plot, which is like our year long story. Right now we're fighting a hag. That's our big meta plot. We have a bunch of treasures and we're fighting a hag. And so the scenarios may contribute to that. They may advance that plot, but they also might be totally self-contained and have nothing to do with that. So those are our bread and butter. We've also got bounties, which are shorter adventures. They're usually about an hour long, maybe an hour and a half. They're for lower level characters right now. Most of them are level 1. Some of them we've released for level 3 characters as well. They don't assume necessarily that the characters are Pathfinders. They just assume that you're people who are looking for coin. So it might be something a Pathfinder does in their downtime, or you might just not be a Pathfinder at all. But you get hired to do a job. Go round up some dinosaurs. Go track down this missing person. Go find this treasure in a ship. Pretty simple, really easy to get into. If you're a new GM, I highly recommend starting with them. They give you like a quick skill challenge or maybe an NPC interaction and then a combat to run, and then you're done and you're out. We've also started, or we've revived rather, our quests line. We had quests way back at the start of Pathfinder Society 2nd edition, but we've revived them. Our new quests are 2-hour adventures. They're a little bit meatier. They do assume that your player characters are Pathfinders, but they're a way for us to have those smaller adventures. One of the things we're seeing as we emerge into 2023 and what the world looks like now is that a lot of game stores are closing earlier. They don't necessarily have time for a 4-hour scenario on a weeknight. Right. And so these quests are kind of aimed at those stores so that people can get there after work, play for a couple of hours, and not have to worry about showing up the next week to finish the other half of a scenario. They can just run through a quest, get some rewards, and move on. They're also great for conventions if you're looking for shorter content, or just anyone who's like, 4 hours sounds like a lot. 2 hours I can do.
Yeah. And is it only those adventures that GMs can run, or can they run Pathfinder adventure paths like Strength of Thousands? It sounds like they can, but yeah. Can they also run homebrew scenarios?
So anything that Paizo will produce, we will look at for sanctioning. And basically what we do is we say, hey, you can play this. Generally, we do it in campaign mode. So it's basically follow whatever rules you want, take as long as you want. It's a little bit more freeform for the GMs because it's just easier that way. And at the end of this adventure, or maybe for an adventure path for each volume of the adventure, you get a chronicle sheet. And you give the players their chronicle sheets, and they can slap that credit onto a character of their choice, generally. Mm-hmm. So it's a way to quickly level some characters up and get some credit. The beginner box that you ran for beginner box day is sanctioned that way, that you can slap the credit on whatever Pathfinder Society character you like. So it gives the GMs a little bit more freedom in those longer adventures. It encourages people to play those with their Pathfinder Society groups, or it just encourages you to, you know, get some extra credit there. As far as homebrew or third-party stuff, that's not something that we generally sanction in the program, because it would just take an incredible amount of our time to review every third-party program out there. We love the folks on Infinite. We love the people who produce the third-party stuff, but there's so much of it out there that we just don't have the capacity to look at if it's as suitable for the campaign as the stuff we produce in-house. But sure. Oftentimes, you know, these groups that form in Pathfinder Society will then go on and play adventure paths or play other campaigns, or someone's got a really cool homebrew idea and they can totally do that. Heck, these groups often move on to other games, things like Call of Cthulhu, Blades in the Dark, Everyday Heroes. And personally, like, I love that, right? I love seeing the community form, seeing people find their people, and just getting to go in game with them. Just finding their gaming group is like the whole point of what we're doing.
That's how my Fist of the Ruby Phoenix adventure is started, was running Pathfinder Society at my local friendly local game store, finding people that I meshed with, and then being like, hey, when I ditch these losers, go play something cool.
Exactly. And like, that's the whole point of it, right? Like, yes, there are people who stick around with Pathfinder Society for like a decade, and I love those people, right? We need those people to be GMs and organizers for the program, so I love them just as much, obviously. But if you play for a couple of years and you find your people and you dip, that's a success story too, right? I love that. There's no wrong way to do it.
So the trepidation that I saw from GMs from Beginner Box Day is the reporting. So what is involved with reporting, and is it all that scary?
It's not, I promise. Like, the scariest part is that sometimes our website glitches and you might have to do it a second time. That's it, I swear. And I know our website is what it is, and I love our tech team. It is what it is. I can only do so much about it.
Right.
But literally, reporting is basically, it's just as simple as like players writing their names down, right? When the players sign in, they write their name, their organized play ID number, and the number for their character, because each character gets a unique number, and what faction their character is. That's it, right? It's so simple. And then all the GM has to do is take that information, go to our website, add that information, add their information, and then say, here's the scenario we played, and here's the date we played it, and here's how successful we were. It takes at most 5 minutes. And there are tools out there, there are websites like RPG Chronicles that can automate so much of the process for you and make it so much simpler. I understand that, like, people see this paperwork and they go, oh no, extra work. It will take you 10 minutes, 15 at most, for the whole thing, for signing in, issuing chronicles, and reporting the games. And it's so important to us to know what people are playing. You know, this is data that we really use. I compile the data every month on how many tables got run. We look at the data for the living campaign aspects to see how scenarios went, how adventures turned out, but also just for a look at the health of the community. Mm-hmm. If we're seeing a lot of low-level stuff and not a lot of high-level stuff being played, just like as a random example, that tells us something about the kind of scenarios we should be producing. Mm-hmm. It tells us maybe we need more mid-levels to kind of get people up. Or maybe it tells us we're not retaining those people. Something's bouncing off those people. They'll play a game or two and then they'll leave. How do we keep them around? So I know it can be a chore at times. I understand that not everybody loves doing spreadsheets and paperwork as much as I do. But it's so, so important for us because it really helps us keep our finger on the pulse of the community.
And I will say, from my own personal experience, specifically with RPG Chronicles, they worked with us to set up the entire convention structure of Beginner Box Days. They have convention support if you are running your own big event, but even as a small event, like, it made it so easy. I reported the entirety of Beginner Box Day, which was, what, over 100 tables in an afternoon. Yeah. And it's just that they make it really, really easy, both for game masters who are reporting their own individual things or for event organizers. So I would personally also say it's not that bad. The only thing I would maybe side eye a little bit is when I have to be at a physical table and writing things down with a pen. Oh, yeah. It's like, but
gamer handwriting, man. Gamer handwriting. And I'm just as guilty of this.
That can be a lot. So what do the game masters get out of running the adventures? You alluded to that they get some more achievement points. So is that it?
Well, they get a sense of pride and accomplishment, I suppose. but yes, so the GMs do get extra achievement points. They get double the achievement points that a player gets. So you're gaining points twice as fast if you GM. But as a GM, you also get a chronicle sheet as if you'd played the game that you get to apply to a character. So the rewards, the gold, any boons that you got out of the scenario, you're not missing out on by running the game. There have been other living campaigns in history's past where if you ran it, you didn't get credit for it. And that is absurd and ridiculous to me, right? We should be rewarding our GMs. So you get rewarded just like a player does, and you get those little bit extras. The other nice thing is, and this doesn't come up as often in this edition, but you always get full rewards as a GM. So if the players miss out on some treasure, or you kill all the characters in the first encounter, you're still going to get full rewards, even if they missed out on stuff. So it does provide not an incentive to put the characters through the wood chipper, but it does mean that you're not going to miss out on stuff if your group is bumbling through and missing out on a bunch of treasure. You're still going to get all the nice stuff. So
right, you don't have to put on kitty gloves just because you feel like missing out.
Exactly. And so we really try to give GMs as many rewards as we can, because like I say, program doesn't exist without them. If we don't have people to run games, nothing's happening.
And also after a certain amount of time, you get that kind of Xbox achievement thing of saying you're a Pathfinder GM on the Paizo website, which is always kind of fun to see.
Yes, we do have sort of a GM ranks that at certain numbers of games run, you get another little glyph for Pathfinder Society. Just a little bit of bling for our GMs. And our five glyph GMs are kind of the best of the best. Those are the people, they've run 150 games. And to get the fifth rank, you also have to go through an evaluation process. You have to sit down with three different venture captains and run them through a game and have them say, yes, you are good at GM. So those really, if you see a five glyph GM, I highly recommend jumping in on their game, because it's a mark of quality. It shows that they really know what they're doing and they are the best of the best.
I aspired to be among that group.
You and me both. I think I have three Novas in Starfinder Society right now, and like, I think I just got my first glyph for Pathfinder, because when do I have time to run things? I'm so busy, but
right.
Someday I shall be there, and I shall be evaluated just like everyone else.
So when someone is ready to GM or is ready to start a local Pathfinder Society, how do they get that off the ground?
There are a lot of ways, I think, to get started as a GM or an organizer, and it really just kind of depends on if you have a local scene. If there is a local Pathfinder scene near you, find out where they run, go to the organizer and say, hello, I would like to GM a game. They will fall over themselves and thank you profusely, because, again, we always need GMs. And they'll get you copies of the scenario. Scenarios. They'll get you, if you need maps and they have maps you can borrow, they can get you that. So if you have a local scene, super easy to get started as a GM. If you don't have as much of a local scene, there's still ways to get things off the ground. The first thing I recommend is find a venue who's willing to host you. That can be a game store. Those are the most typical. But we have games running in libraries. We have games running in bars. We have games running in like community halls, you know, like Rotary clubs or fire halls or things like that. So if you have a space, you find that. You can start running without any kind of, I'll say, official backing, right? You can purchase the scenarios on Paizo.com. They're about $5 each. You can buy them and just start running. Just post on the store's Facebook group or whatever, say, hey, I'm running Pathfinder. Anyone who wants to come down, do it. And as long as you give people ID numbers and you report the game afterwards, that's good. You're an organizer. Mm-hmm. If you want that additional support, if you want that additional help, you can reach out to our volunteers. We have on our website, there's a regions page you can go to that says, here's the regional coordinator. coordinator, find your state, find your country, email that person, say, hey, I'd like to get started in Seattle. How do I do that? If there's volunteers in the area, they can put you in touch. If not, they can always wave the magic wand and make you a venture agent. As a volunteer venture agent, you get PDFs of all of the scenarios for free. So you don't have to worry about that. You just, bada boom, get all of that. You get access to our discussion boards where you can talk with other VOs about, hey, how do I do this thing, right? How do I really make this thing shine? And you get that network. If there's volunteers in your area, they can put you in touch. You can also email me if you can't find the organizer for your area or you just want some help. OrganizedPlay@paizo.com. I am more than happy to help out organizers. I get requests all the time from players, from GMs, from venues who are like, hey, we want Pathfinder Society in our store. And if I've got an organizer I can put them in touch with, it's like, hey, I got an email from this guy 2 weeks ago who's running in such and such city. Form that connection, and then we've got a Pathfinder group there. So there's tons of ways to get started. You don't need, again, that official backing, but if you just want to run Pathfinder Society, you can run Pathfinder Society. No one's ever going to stop you.
And then if I wanted to start playing Pathfinder Society today,
yes,
like after I, the listener, get done listening to this, I'm like, okay, Pathfinder Society isn't scary. I want to do it. How do I join a game this afternoon?
Yeah. So the first thing I would recommend, we have new getting started landing pages actually on paizo.com. And I don't know if there's a description to put the link in, but please do, because the link is long. It's like,
absolutely.
paizo.com/Pathfinder Society/get started. So I apologize for the multiple layers there, but that's like an overview. It's everything I've said here. It's here's the basics. Here's everything you might want to know before you sit down. You don't have to go there, but I recommend it. I spent a lot of time on it and I think it looks good. But if you're looking for...
It is much easier to find information than before.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, yes. But if you're looking for a game, there's ways to find games, right? If you go to our online region run games around the clock all of the time. PFSChat.com is the link to their sort of central Discord server where you can find online games. If you're looking for games in your area, again, you can visit that region page and email the coordinator to say, hey, I'm a player looking for games in Seattle. They can put you in touch with our volunteers. You can Google search Pathfinder Society Seattle or whatever city you're in. Even sites like Warhorn and Meetup are used for scheduling games. Go search Warhorn, go search, Meetup for games near you. Or again, email me, organizedplay@paizo.com, and I'll put you in touch with the right people. Our groups always try and maintain, robust web presences. That varies from city to city, but if you search for it, it'll be out there. And there's so many ways. If you just hop into a Discord and say, hey, I need help finding games in a place, we will be thrilled to help you. Our volunteers will be thrilled to help you. There is no way that the reason you can't play Pathfinder Society is I cannot find a game. We will help you find a game.
There are a lot out there, and there's no more than in PaizoCon coming up. I am very excited for. I'll be running games all week, but I know that there are several other GMs who are running. There's stuff going on all weekend long. Memorial weekend. That's Paizo. I don't think it's PaizoCon.com.
Actually, PaizoCon.com does go there. It does.
Oh, does it? Okay, cool. PaizoCon.com. Go there, find a game, try it out. It's not scary. It's really, really fun. I have always had a blast. When I was at PaizoCon last year, that was all that I wanted to do, was game master for Pathfinder Society. A couple of my games fell through just because it was a light year by design. But when you get to play, there is nothing quite like meeting a lot of new people, a lot of new players who bring new stuff to a game that you don't get from your home. You kind of get used to how your players play, and having like people bring in different energies, different styles of play. It's really, really fun. So if you're not already a game master, try game mastering. If you're not a player, I really suggest going and playing. And PaizoCon, I think, is probably one of the best places that you could start.
Absolutely, yeah. PaizoCon, any of our low-level games, our 1-4 games in general, are always suitable for new players. But especially at PaizoCon, we know we're going to have a lot of eyes on us. There's a lot of interest in Pathfinder all of a sudden for unknown reasons. and so we're going to really make sure to welcome those new players. And to another point that you mentioned, like, even as a GM, sitting at other GMs' tables, I've learned so much about, like, how to be a better GM. Mm-hmm. tips and tricks. Those of us who are forever GMs, you know, we don't often get to play at other GMs' tables. We don't often get that chance. And Pathfinder Society is a really great way to just be like, I'm going to take 4 hours for myself and go play and do that and pick up a trick or two. So yeah, join us at PaizoCon Online in a couple weeks. As you said, it's Memorial Day weekend. We've got games running all weekend, all time zones. At our next big event after that is Gen Con, of course, in Indianapolis and online. We're supporting Gen Con Online as well. We've got plenty of games, introductory games at both conventions. Find your local conventions as well. A lot of these local conventions, everything from like the 50, 60,000 person pop culture cons down to the couple hundred people gaming cons, more likely than not, they'll have Pathfinder people there. We have hundreds of events I send support to every year. So it's probably happening in your backyard, unless you live in like the middle of nowhere. The North Pole, I don't think has games. I don't think we have games at the Antarctic Research Station, but I would like to. If there's any polar explorers and or astronauts listening to this podcast, talk to me. I want Pathfinder in space. I want Starfinder in space. Talk to me. Let's make something happen.
And of course, even if you are, there's online options to play Pathfinder Society too. So always a way to play. Well, Alex, it has been such a treat having you on. I hope that you as a listener have gained this wisdom and now know that Pathfinder Society, it's not scary. It's a thing that you should try out, and I hope that you will. Alex, do you have any final pieces of advice for our listeners, and where can people find more of you?
Yeah, well, if you would like to find more of me, you can find me on Twitter at Alex Spidel. I guess you can find me on Mastodon too. You can't find me on Blue Sky yet, but you know, that's kind of my public social media presence. I have a couple of adventures that I've written, I guess I should plug as well. I recently wrote Pathfinder Society 408, Battle for Stars Fate, where you meet a sad robot turtle. And I love them very much. And so does everyone else. I'm also releasing an upcoming Starfinder Society at Gen Con, an upcoming Starfinder Society scenario with my name on it. Tomorrow's Seekers, where you'll get to actually vote on the new first Seeker. But that's a whole other conversation there. As far as final pieces of advice, like, I know I'm kind of beating the drum here, but like, just go out and play Pathfinder Society. I understand any reason why you might have trepidation, but I promise that if you sit at a table with us for a couple of hours, you'll have a lovely time, you'll have a great time, and you'll learn so much. And then it won't be scary anymore. And then you'll bring your friend next time, and it'll just, it'll be a great time, and you'll have some lovely adventures. And if you need adventure recommendations, I'm always happy to draw.
Well, thank you, Alex. And thank you, listener, for joining us. I'm sorry I don't put out more episodes. There has been a lot going on, especially with Beginner Box Days and now PaizoCon coming up, where I will be running my own game show, Play Test Test, where I'm going to have Mark Seifter, Luis Loza, and Liz Liddell, all creators and developers for Pathfinder 2nd Edition, two of which the original ones. And we're going to see how well they know the current rules from the ones that they started making out and were throwing spaghetti at the wall. So I hope you'll join me for that, as well as any of the, I believe, 6 games that I'm running over PaizoCon. So please check me out. And of course, if you want to follow me, go to Rulelord2e on Twitter. I'm trying to find a different landing spot.
Aren't we all?
We'll see where that ends up, but anywhere that I do end up, it'll be at Rulelord2e. And then, of course, I would love to hear your community use policy voiceovers. That's where you just read out the community use policy and then email it to me, and I will play it at the start of each episode. You can give out your group a little shout out, one of your loved ones. I love to get them. I love to air them. So make sure to send that to me at rulelord2e@gmail.com. Other than that, listeners, go play Pathfinder Society, and you will have to let the rules rule you in that case, but in general, don't let the rules rule you.